date, the beginning of January, again, a very similar process. I was in Mississippi the other week. They're just getting started. So there's a great deal of exciting innovation going on at the state level, and I find it very encouraging. And I think also I see, the more I travel in the different states, the greater the likelihood that we will have a solution that grows organically, if you will, from the bottom up, as opposed to is something worked out in Washington as one size fits all. It's a very complicated issue to deal with in any single state, and having seen that close up and firsthand, each state has its own set of circumstances, its own demographics, geography, the way its health system is organized, the financing, etc. And it's a very complicated undertaking in any state. And to try to do that nationally all at once is to just take that complexity and multiply it by 50 to start with. And I think that is a reason why you haven't seen as much out of the federal level. That said, what I would like to talk with you about today and share with you are the rationales and methods for moving health care and the health system in this state or in any other in more of a patient-centered or consumer-centered direction. And by that I mean into a system in which the patient and the patient's needs come first, and they have more control and decision-making throughout the system. With your permission, I think I would like to start with a bit of a presentation. I will tell you that I don't have a lot of slides. I deliberately don't try to put my entire presentation on slides. Rather, this is really to illustrate, these are 10 slides, really to illustrate some key points and a few graphics in here. I'm going to start actually jumping in a little further down, because you can order this presentation in several different ways. And I'm going to talk about the why for a few minutes. So let me move to that. Why would one want to move to the kind of consumer-centered or patient-centered system that I'm talking about? Well, the first and most important reason in my mind is to create new incentives and dynamics for value maximization. In healthcare, we talk about cost and access a lot, and I'm sure committees such as yours are constantly talking about these issues of cost of health care and access to health care, the uninsured, etc. But at the end of the day, I think it really comes down ultimately to a question of value. Cost and access can be subsumed under the question of value. And the way I would put it is this: what are we getting for our money? And I think, regardless of party or philosophy, we can all pretty much agree that there's a lot that's good about the American health system, but there's a lot of shortcomings as well. We feel that it's not bad, but we feel maybe we're not getting our money's worth. Maybe for all this money we're spending, we ought to be getting better results. Ultimately, I think what we would all like to see is a system where we not only get better results, but we actually spend less money. In other words, we get more for less. And if you ask the average person on the street what do they think of by value, they mean, hey, getting more for less. That's what we see in other sectors of the economy. We not only see it in the more obvious ones like electronics and computers, where the new models are twice as good as the last year's and half the price, but we even see it in sectors of the economy where we think productivity doesn't increase that much, such as retailing. Professor Regina Herzlinger at Harvard Business School points out that, and as does Michael Porter there at Harvard Business School, points out that the economic boom in the last 10 years, which may be coming to a dip in the road at the moment, was driven in large measure by productivity in the retail sector, more so than the manufacturing sector. So if this goes on in other sectors, why can't we get more for less? Why don't the price of MRIs ever come down, no matter how many we have out there? Why can't we change the system? And the reason is that we have a system that doesn't reward people for offering more for less. It rewards them for charging more, for doing more as an excuse to charge more, but with rare exceptions does it reward people for offering more at less. The rare exceptions are often those which are not in the traditional health system. The example people use recently is LASIK eye surgery, where indeed, as the technology has diffused, the prices have come down and the quality has gone up simultaneously. there's nothing magic about that. There are other forms of surgery that could apply as well. So the first and from a health policy perspective, most important reason I would say to move towards a more patient-centered system is that's the only way you're really going to get to increasing the value proposition in healthcare. The other reason is that you're going to be able to offer more flexibility to employers and to their workers. Right now, we have a fairly rigid system. We used to have this in the pension area as well, where the idea was that you had an employer who offered you some sort of defined benefit plan and you had to work 30 years for it and you got so much based on the average of how much you worked at the end of your, etc. Well, that was fine when you worked for 30 years for General Motors, but it doesn't apply in today's economy of smaller businesses and people changing jobs frequently. What the government did was to create new tools to allow alternative arrangements for pension plans. You're familiar with those, 401ks and IRAs, that better suited that segment of the workforce. Now, that doesn't mean you can't still run a defined benefit pension plan, and some employers do, and I would imagine the state of Oregon probably does for its workers. But what it does do is it gives additional flexibility to people in the economy, both on the employer side and the employee side. And that's something that we need in the health system. So moving from a system that is premised on the idea that the employer is going to make all the decisions about the health insurance plan to one in which the employee has more choice and options, and the employer is simply facilitating that, is a system that will help both the employers and the workers, and gets to the next point, which is once the coverage attaches to people instead of the jobs, and I will show some data on this later, then you have a reasonable expectation that fewer people will become uninsured in the first place. And as policymakers, as lawmakers, that should be of concern to you, because if people are constantly churning in and out of coverage, the idea that you're going to cover everybody with some set of laws or policies or subsidies becomes very difficult when you don't even know who those people are and it keeps changing as you deliberate. The other part that is also of relevance is that to you as lawmakers, is that a consumer-centered or patient-centered system gives you a new metric around which to better focus the money that the public is already spending, the tax dollars you are responsible for, to better focus that to say, can we help the most people in the most effective way? Now, essentially, we have, as I mentioned, a payer-centered system. In this system, the payer calls the shots. They may go through insurers, or they may go around the insurers and just go direct to the providers. An example in the public sector would be a Medicaid program that contracts directly with providers. An example in the private sector would be a self-insured employer that deals either directly or through a third-party administrator with providers. The relevant point is that the patient out here is the one on the side for whom this all supposedly is being done for their benefit and who demands the care from the provider. But if you notice, they're not in the real chain of command. Now, one of the interesting observations when you look at this is organizationally a single payer system doesn't look all that different. There's a lot of interest in single payer. What you're doing is you're simply removing a number of people from that equation, but the basic equation is pretty much the same. The patient is over there on the side. What is different about a patient-centered system is you notice we swap out the patient and the payer, and this is where the key comes in. It is the patient who is, or the consumer who is choosing the insurer, and again, they either deal directly, they either go through the insurer and dealing with the providers, in other words, there's a reimbursement arrangement there, or say they opt for a health savings account, higher deductible insurance option, which may suit some people, then a certain portion of what they are obtaining, they buy directly from the provider as opposed to going through the insurer. The relevant point is that the insurers now work for somebody different. They work for you and me as patients and consumers. The role of the payers, the employer and the government, is to facilitate these transactions, to make it simple and easy for us to do it, and to help us afford it. In the case of the employer, they provide a mechanism whereby we can leverage the generous federal tax subsidy so that when we buy our health insurance, it's all tax-free. They can make it easy for us by running it all through a payroll withholding system, et cetera. In the case of the government, it's an issue of subsidizing those who you as a legislature determine need additional assistance in buying this because they have lower incomes. But the key decision is made by the patient, and that first decision is what kind of insurance plan do I want to have from the menu of product offerings. Now, one of the interesting things if you go back and look at a payer-centered system is that payers, not surprisingly, care about three things: cost, cost, and cost. And as a consequence, if the insurer works for the payer, the insurer is in a position of trying to deliver lower costs in ways that may or may not be in the interest of the patient or the consumer. This is why you see, for example, some of the, quote, roadblocks to getting health care. Well, if people never get the care and never file a claim, that controls the cost. This is why you see the selective contracting and networking. Well, if they only go to the cheapest doctors around, that controls the cost. But in the world in which you or I buy the care, and or you and I buy the insurance, is that the answer that we want to hear? Now, I don't know about you, but personally, I would gravitate towards the lowest premium if given a menu of options. But then I'd ask the question, well, why is it the lowest premium? Now, one reason might be, such as a high deductible plan, that it doesn't cover as much. Well, okay, for some people, that's all right. They're prepared to do it. For other people, they're not. They're not comfortable with that. Okay, fine. Let's say that you're one of those people that isn't comfortable. So you're lowest cost and you're not a high deductible plan. Well, why are you lowest cost? Well, that's because we throw up a lot of roadblocks to you actually getting a claim paid. Well, that's not what I want to hear. Well, we're lowest cost because you can only go to these doctors over here who take very low reimbursement. Well, that's not what I want to hear either. What I'd like to hear is somebody say, oh, we're the lowest cost because we figured out how to save money by keeping you healthy, one. And two, we figured out that if you do need something, we can give you all the information on where to go to get it at the best price with the best results. So if you need an orthopedic procedure or you need a heart procedure or whatever, we figured out where you ought to get it. And here's all the information. I mean, don't take our word for it. We're going to lay that information out for you. But our experience is that if people follow our advice, they wind up, you know, getting better care at 40% less. Now, if you look at the work that people like John Wenberg at Dartmouth have done on the disparities in healthcare spending and results around the country, or the alternatives, the examples, the case studies of success that Regina Herzlinger and Michael Porter at Harvard Business School focus on, it's very clear from looking at that, both on what isn't working and what is working, that the idea that you could double or triple the benefits, that you could have much higher success rates, much longer survival rates in cancer, things like that, and do so while reducing costs 10, 20, 30, 40% or more, this is all demonstrably something that can be done. The problem is we don't have a system that incentivizes people to do more of it and rewards people when they do it or when they find it. So that's why we would want to move to this system. Another reason is what I touched on earlier, and that is coverage and stability. Let me just present you a little data here, and I don't want to get too deep into it. But when we look at the uninsured, we tend to look at data that is really a snapshot at any given point in time. This is data, and it's a little old, but it's the best longitudinal data we have from the Census Bureau's Survey of Income and Program Participation. This is a longitudinal survey where you ask, you get a statistical sample of people, respondents, and you ask them the same questions every couple months and see how the answers change as their lives evolve over a period of 2, 3, or in this case, 4 years. What you see represented here are those people in this, or the extrapolations from this study, of those people in there who at any point in this 48-month period experienced 1 month or more of being uninsured. So the people who were insured the entire time are not included. more than the raw numbers, what's really interesting is the percentages in the coverage patterns. One-third of those people were repeatedly, not once, but twice or more, repeatedly had spells of uninsurance within a 48-month period. Another 29% were basically insured most of the time, but had one gap of relatively short duration, or certainly shorter than half the time. So my editorializing on the right is that that would suggest they might be fairly easy to address, because over the 4 years, these people, and in fact most of the third group as well, were insured more often than they were uninsured. So it's really a question of getting the coverage to stick to them. Only 12% were uninsured the entire 4 years. Another 6% were basically uninsured the entire 4 years, but maybe had one period of coverage. Now, what I did then was to take data from another table that was published in this study, and this table that you see here does not appear in the study. It's a combination of what you just saw and another table. I've just done this for purposes of clarity. And to say, well, let's look at that distribution of these people by not only their coverage status, going down the left side, but also by their income. And so we disaggregate. So what you see is that total adds up to 100%, but they're disaggregated into all those little boxes. And then I applied a couple of what I would think are reasonable assumptions. I assumed that anybody in the first three categories, repeatedly uninsured, one coverage gap, or transitional, that really it's a question of getting the coverage to stick to the person, and that given that demonstrably more often than not in the four-year period they were covered, maybe if we just got the coverage to stick to them instead of the job, we could start to solve the problem. The other assumption I made is that I don't care how often you had coverage in this group, if you're below 200% of poverty, we're probably going to have to subsidize it somehow to some degree. Now, you know, one can draw the line, and I just had to draw it at 2 because they didn't divide it at 3. I mean, one could make this argument, well, it should be 253, but that's not the point. This is not an exercise in precision. This is an exercise in what the business consultants call, how big is your bread box? If you look at those yellow, what that is those are people who most of the time were covered and who were above 200% of poverty. Well, that's 41% of the population that were uninsured. What that suggests is that if the insurance simply stuck to them instead of the job, you could have them covered with little or no need for additional subsidies. That it's a problem of it not fitting their economic and lifestyle patterns. Then I said, well, anybody, even if they have coverage most of the time below 200% of poverty, and let's assume, you know, even people above 400% of poverty, if they don't seem to have ever been insured much, we're just going to assume those all those people are deathly ill, though in fact they probably include lots of people who are perfectly healthy and just didn't buy it. But to be on the conservative side, let's just assume they're all very sick. So let's assume those people are all going to need a lot of subsidy, or some subsidy. That's 43%, and then let's assume the people who are both demonstrably less coverage experience and lower income are going to need a lot of subsidies. So you're looking at maybe 16%. Now, this is national figures. Okay, this will vary from state to state. In states where I have had some data and been able to triangulate it further, your variations are things like a wealthier state like a Maryland or a Massachusetts, instead of maybe 41% of your problem going away without spending any money, you could get as high as 50% of your problem going away. A poorer state like a Louisiana, you're looking at only 25%. Ohio, California, Indiana, they've come in at around 33%. Okay, for various reasons related to the economy and then what share of their workforce is the low-wage sector. But the point to you as policymakers is, with the right design, you might start off in a situation where by simply making it easier for people to keep coverage, you solve some of the problem, and then you can better focus the money that you've got already on the remaining people who need some subsidies. So, the more people that never lose coverage, the fewer the uninsured. Covering the remaining becomes easier and possibly less costly. The other point is, of course, that more stable financing becomes the precondition for what we were talking about earlier, which is to realign the system incentives and dynamics to produce better results and outcomes and better value for money. If people are bouncing around from insurance policy to insurance policy or in and out of coverage, with this doc, that doc, maybe, you know, getting their care at this clinic, of course we have a fragmented, costly system. Okay, that starts to change. Now, I'll just, since I'm here in Oregon, I'll have to, and I'm sure the good senator won't mind, but I had the occasion to discuss this with your senator, Ron Wyden, and his staff. This was over a year ago. And one of the things we were talking about was how the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, which your senator and his staff are all covered by, operates on this kind of a consumer choice model. And one of the advantages of that is people actually, when given a choice in any given year, only about 11% of people switch coverage, because you see this pattern where people find something they like and stick with it. And at that point, one of the senator's staffers who was there in the meeting, she pointed out that she had had the same coverage with FEHBP for 6 years, and she really loved it, et cetera, and talked about why she chose it and why it was a great thing. The other one, who had just joined his staff, said, you know, in my last job, I had 5 different plans in 5 years. Because the employer was always switching the coverage for, you know, a slightly smaller premium. So when you consider that scenario, you say, well, who's going to get better continuity and coverage? Who's going to have the incentive, which insurer is going to have the incentive to invest up front in preventive care? The one where you're picking it and you like it and you're comfortable with it and you may stay with it for 5 or 6 or 7 years, or the one where if they invest up front, it just makes them more expensive and they lose that employer contract the next year? Okay, let me go back to where we start actually on this. That was the why. The what. The what, and this is what Massachusetts did in a limited extent, is essentially 2, possibly 3 basic things. The first is to restructure the insurance markets to create a patient-centered or patient-driven system as opposed to a payer-driven one. That's the first big element. The second big element is to use the infrastructure created by doing that, when you move from a payer-driven to a patient-driven system, to then piggyback on it by restructuring your public subsidies. Shift from what is essentially a provider-focused to a patient-focused system. Medicaid and Medicare are not about whether Mrs. Smith gets the operation. They're all about what the doc gets paid if the doc operates on Mrs. Smith. Okay? That's the world that we're in. It's a provider-centered world, not a patient-centered world. It's not about whether that's the right thing to do for Mrs. Smith or whether that's the right doctor to do it. It's all about what the doc gets paid.
Just one point on that. I'd like to have you address the incentives that are inherent in the system, because if it's about what is going to be paid to a provider, providers want to maintain their income, and so any change in the system has to, for it to be acceptable to the providers, has to continue to provide an income level that they're currently getting.
Oh, yeah. And that's where the difficulty comes in here. And the message to all of the other players in this, the providers, the insurers, et cetera, is I believe that you can do quite well in this system, in a revised system. But you will have to go about your business differently. Okay? You will be rewarded for doing better, not necessarily for just doing more.
As we go along, would you explain how that would happen?
Yeah, and we can explain how to do it. An insurer, to get rewarded with increased market share, would have to demonstrate that they're identifying and passing back to you, the customer, greater value. In other words, better results at a lower price. And people who can do that get to keep some of the value as profits, and so they should. The third point, which you may or may not get into in your state, is that restructuring your markets and your public subsidies in some states does lay the two essential preconditions for things that need to be done to restructure the delivery system. Now, this is very, very state-specific, and it really gets into geography and demographics and how your system is organized right now. But it does... I do put it on there to make the point that if you move down this path starting in the insurance markets and then in the public subsidy side, you get to a point where solving some of those access questions, say in rural areas, or some of those disparities, you suddenly discover that you've got new tools for doing this and you've got a better foundation on which to build those delivery system reforms. And there are lots of creative things that can be done in that area, including things like medical education reforms, et cetera. I won't spend too much on that unless folks want me to. Finally, and this will be my last slide, how do you get there? Again, going back to the point that the first step is to restructure the insurance markets. If you're building a house, this is your foundation. The next step is the other things you add on top of the foundation. So what does that foundation look like? A state essentially can authorize something that is really a hybrid insurance product. It has the best features of both the individual and the group market, meaning that it is individually owned and portable, which is what we like about the individual market, but it is tax favored as employer group coverage if the employer brings you in, and it meets federal standards for being guaranteed issue during open season to people. So the first step is the state uses its power to authorize the creation of these kinds of products. Then the state can establish some sort of exchange mechanism to administer the market in which these products are bought and sold. So in other words, the employer's plan is no longer to say, well, I've got 10 employees and I, you know, will pay Blue Cross so much to, you know, in premiums that they demand to cover all 10. No, the employer says, I'm going to go to the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange or market. That will be my plan. What does my plan consist of? It consists of a menu of choices of state-approved insurance that all meet minimum federal standards from which you may pick your coverage. And we can all do this with tax-free money. And it's guaranteed issue at standard rates. And Oregon will define what those standard rates are. Are they adjusted by geography? Are they adjusted by age? Things like that. Now, this exchange can also be defined and chartered by you as a state legislature. There are a couple of models for doing this. The first is the one that we devised, which was originally developed in D.C., though not enacted yet there, and was used in designing Massachusetts. And that is the kind of special purpose TPA model. In other words, a state legislature would charter a special purpose third-party administrator. In Massachusetts, they call this the Health Insurance Connector. And that is who would run the system. And the advantage of this model is it can be designed in a way where the employer can where you can allow the employer to offload as much of the liability and responsibility as possible under federal law onto somebody else to run. So it's like a kind of giant common HR department for businesses to opt into. Well, at the point at which you do that, then it's really dead simple for anybody, any employer in the state to offer a health plan, because all they have to really do is go down and sign up. There's no more of the hassles involved in offering a health plan. Now, the trade-off is, of course, you're going to have an entity to run it and people to do it, and some people are uncomfortable about the state authorizing that kind of a bureaucracy. That seems a bit frightening to them. Okay. But if you do that, the employer no longer has to administer the plan. So legally, under federal law, that entity is the plan administrator. Now,
I'd like to ask a couple of questions, and as we go along, there's so much information.
I know
if there needs to be some questions asked, I think we ought to do as we go. If this were done, a group employer wants to do this. He has 100 employees. Does he basically say, I'm presently spending $650 a month per employee, that's what I'm going to offer? Or does he say, I'm going to purchase a basic plan, and then if employees want additional benefits, they can pay more and buy add-ons? I mean, how does that actually work?
What the employer would do is the employer would sign you up and say, this is going to be my health plan, and under federal law, the plan is not an insurance product. It's the arrangement that the employer establishes with respect to its employees. So when I use the term plan, it means this arrangement. So I'm going to have a plan that consists of all these health insurance products which you may choose from. Now, the state can define the other side of that agreement, which is, okay, Mr. and Mrs. Employer, we will take you if you agree to the following: that you're going to give us all your employees, that you're going to, as part of your plan, have a Section 125 plan, so regardless of what you, the employer, contribute, the employee share of the premium is all done on a pre-tax basis.
Define 125.
Yeah, it's a Section 125 of the Internal Revenue Code, and what it does is it allows an employer to offer at a minimum a choice to the employees of taking taxable cash or taking pre-tax, using the money pre-tax, to buy health benefits. Now, the employer can then add to that any number of other things. They can say, well, you can use this pre-tax money to put more into your 401k on top of what I'm already giving you, up to the federal maximum. You could use this pre-tax money to fund a dependent care account, up to the federal maximum. You can buy extra life insurance, up to the federal maximum. In other words, it's a menu, a cafeteria approach. At its simplest form, though, what it means is this. It creates an arrangement whereby anything the employer puts in, whatever the employee has to pay, is also done on the same pre-tax basis. So given that any money the employer is, quote, spending is really money that the employer isn't giving the employee as cash wages, 100% of the money is really the employee's, and you've now got an arrangement where 100% of what is used to buy health care, regardless of what the employee chooses, regardless of how it's divided employer-employee, will be tax-free. So what you're doing is you're fully leveraging the federal tax code as it exists today with respect to those employees. Now, when I meet with Senator Wyden and others in Washington, it's about how we ought to change the federal tax code, but that's a whole other subject, which we won't get into here. So this is designed for you all to work at the state level within the construct of federal law. Now, the point is simply that another model for the exchange is a virtual exchange, and Utah is working on this, where there really isn't a single entity. They're even looking at banks getting in there and being the intermediary, saying, look, we do payroll withholding for these employers already. This is just one more thing in the payroll withholding. We'll collect the money, send it to the insurance companies. The insurance department just puts out the information, and the employers sign up, et cetera. One can do that. And we were just meeting with the Department of Labor on some of these ideas, the Federal Department of Labor. One can do that. It simply means that more of the responsibility for running all of this stays with the employer, and more of the liability, because you've now decentralized it. But there's a lot of attraction to that as well. I mean, you know, have e-health insurance or somebody like that run the online portal, have the banks do the business banking withholding. I mean, there's some attraction to that. So you could do it in a couple of different models. The point is simply in these next two bullets, and the employers can offer this as their plan, and the workers can choose the coverage. And then, and this is what Massachusetts did, this becomes the administrative platform whereby the state leverages that mechanism to then say, well, we're going to use that as a way to subsidize some people we feel need subsidizing to buy into this system, because even though they're working and have income, it's not sufficient. In the state of Massachusetts, they have their particular source of money and their particular target population. Each other state will have to look at its sources of funding and its target populations. The point is that once you've got a system like this, administratively it becomes easier, because that's simply another payment stream that is added on top of whatever the individual and the employer are paying. So it's just an accounting exercise on the back end. The other thing, finally, is that states will look at companion measures to go with this, such as risk adjustment among the insurers, such as I mentioned earlier, some of the delivery system reforms that they might think would be suitable for their state, particularly states with rural issues. Those come into play here. You've been very generous, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, letting me talk this long. I will stop at this point and be happy to take your questions.
Questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Great presentation. A lot of us for quite a while now have been following the Massachusetts plan. Obviously, that was a real leader in this. And more recently, although it's been sidetracked, the similar plan that they were looking at in California. My question is, can a plan like the one that's in place in Massachusetts or the one that's being discussed in California and other places, can it happen? Can it be successful without the mandate component of it?
The answer is that will vary on the design of your plan. I'll make 2 points on that. The first is it's important when comparing, and people do because they're the most obvious, compare Massachusetts and California. It's important to understand that what happened in California was the opposite of what happened in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, they set about doing what I talked about here, first redesigning their insurance system, then redesigning the public subsidies around it. At the end of the process came the questions, okay, now that we've made this system more affordable, more accessible, in other words, it's dead simple now to sign up, dead simple to be an employer. You don't have to run your own plan. You just go to the connector. And we've created a subsidies for people that we think need subsidies. Now at this point, having gone through all these questions and details, do we need to still make people buy it? Because we've made it pretty attractive. Mm-hmm. And secondly, do we need more money? So they ask those two questions, I say money and mandates, at the end. Now what happens is everybody focused when it happened on money and mandates, and California went out and did the opposite. They started with money and mandates. They said, well, we're going to make everybody buy it, now we've got to find a way to pay for it. And as a result, the design that came out in California, in my opinion, was really just an expansion of what you have today. It wasn't a really transformational change. So I advise any state to take the approach Massachusetts did, is to work out the design as if you didn't have any money and you couldn't apply any mandates. You had to encourage and induce people into the system. Now, you could do things like automatic enrollment, you know, where the lazy people are in, you know, the default settings, if you were there. I've been cautioned not to use the word default in the case of healthcare or other financial service products, lest anybody think I'm talking about the product. But the automatic option. Okay, and we found this with 401ks. I mean, with 401k plans, when the federal government authorized those and employers put them out there and said, well, you know, here's a great way to save for retirement. You know, if you put some money in, I'll match it. And they didn't get anybody taking them up. And then they changed it and they said, well, look, here, all you just have to do is sign this piece of paper that says, no, you don't want my free money in your retirement account. Well, suddenly 80% of them were taking them up on the offer. So there are little things like that. But you walk through it and you say, let's start with the assumption that we don't have any more money than we've got already in the system, and that we got to get to 90%+ of people wanting to get into this without having to mandate it. And I think you'll come out in a lot better position to think about that at the end. Then finally, when you do get to that position, it's not necessarily a question of mandating that people buy insurance. Massachusetts, what the governor did was he proposed a plan that would reduce premiums and thus make it more affordable for people who didn't need subsidies. He would subsidize people who were lower income, and he would create these insurance market reforms so there was one place for everybody to get it, and it was dead simple to do for employers. And his position was, okay, if we made it cheaper and easier and subsidized, you're out of excuses for not having insurance. Now, if you don't have insurance, fine, but it's your problem, not ours. In other words, you're the one who didn't take us up on this. It's no longer the big bad hospital collecting. You know, you should have bought something. So they put in personal responsibility provisions that said, you know, we'll escrow your tax refund until and we'll pay you interest. But you know, if the providers come after you, there's a source of money. Or if there's a judgment against you for not paying your bills, then, you know, it'll be automatic wage garnishment. They won't have to go to court a second time. It's like child support. You know, we're not going to have the taxpayer stuck with it. But his point was, first we fix the system before we do that. Now, legislature didn't go along with that. They simply replaced that with buy insurance or we fine you.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think the governor had the better idea, but, you know, that's how these processes work. You don't ever, you know, nobody gets 100% of what they want.
Mr. Chair, real quick, where can we find, those of us who are interested, where can we find sort of the definitive history of the Massachusetts plan? I mean, I guess my point is, it's
so coming
critical
to our website shortly.
Well, I mean, is there, it has a book, you know, maybe
no,
it is a book.
It hasn't, and in fact, this
it helps us to understand that
no,
there's a lot of work to get to that.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, this is what we are trying to do with this, is to publish as much as we can to sort this out. And in fact, we're in the process. I'm not exaggerating. It literally will be coming to our website shortly. Look, we're trying to evaluate it because we see it as a prototype.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we see that there's certain basic concepts that are novel, okay? But you can learn from the details. And some of it is very Massachusetts specific, but some of it is, hey, yeah, you know, it's like when the Wright brothers flew. I mean, anybody remember the first plane? It had the propellers on the back, okay? Remember, they used to do that, put the propellers on the back of the plane, pushing it instead of. They changed that after a while, okay? It was through trial and experimentation. Well, it's the same sort of thing here. So we're trying to publish articles, and we are actually have collected the data, and we'll continue to collect the data. It's just getting it in a format and on the website. Because the other thing to understand is that this is being phased in over basically a two-year period. So to make judgments about it, you have to know where you are in the process. So we're trying to put that because there's a lot of interest in there, and you know, put it at, collect as much as we can and put it out there in the public interest.
Thank
yeah.
you. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the presentation. A couple of questions. One, how does this deal with how would this proposal deal with pre-existing conditions? Can you talk a little bit about that when we have insurance that's attached to the person rather than the employer? Does that suggest as well that that person can't be denied coverage when they shift, you know, from one plan to another or find their financial situation has changed? So they're
that's absolutely right. They can't.
Okay.
They can't. And that's part of it being on the outside, it is group insurance, and therefore they have those protections. On the inside, however, it's individual coverage. And so what you're doing is you're starting, the first place is to start is to say, well, you're essentially creating this option for employers. Because remember, you as a state can't force the employer to do anything. So you're creating this new option. You're saying instead of having to go buy a group plan for 10 people from Blue Cross or Aetna, and then they put on you the burden of trying to get 8 out of 10 to sign up because they won't give you the contract if you know you don't meet the minimum participation because they don't want just the sick people. Instead of doing that, just bring them here, and we'll work with them, and each one of them will pick something, and it'll be a guaranteed issue. Now, that's the first step. Then you have a question, and this question came up in an earlier meeting. You've got two other steps you can do. One is you can now start subsidizing people based on economic need, as we discussed. Two is you can say, well, we can let the individual market or some portion of that, say the self-employed portion, get in here as well. Now, in that case, you have, if you make that choice to say that we're going to do that, then you have to deal with those issues a slightly different way. And what you would do is you would say, well, yes, it is guaranteed issue, but again, this is limited guarantees, only at open season. Okay? So you can't just pick it up and drop it any time of the year. And two, for people coming in from the individual market, we would say, well, the extent to which you buy at standard rates is based on whether you have credible prior coverage. In other words, you have to earn the right to have that guaranteed issue by staying insured. You can't just say, well, I don't want to be insured until I need it. So what we designed is to say, for those coming in from the individual market, if you had 18 months or more prior coverage, then yes, you buy at standard rates, guaranteed issue during open season, same as everybody else who was brought in the employer market. If you have less than that, the insurers can surcharge you up to 150% of premium for the first couple of years and can charge imposed pre-existing condition exclusions up to 12 months. Basically, that's the maximum under the federal law. And so even if somebody came in with no prior coverage and had that imposed, that would be what would be the federal law maximum for, say, a high-risk pool. Okay, the principle is that you should if you do the right thing, you're rewarded. If you buy and keep coverage, you're rewarded by being able to change coverage at standard rates, a guaranteed issue, without once a year, not any time, but once a year. If you want that privilege, though, you have to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bauer.
Just a comment. I mean, Oregon's high risk pool. Is actually pretty successful, and so, I mean, I don't think you're working in areas that are uncharted, and Oregon mm-hmm. doesn't do a pretty good job, and so I think that clearly is something that doesn't add more new dollars to the system. We are already doing that.
Yeah, and I would simply make the point: these pieces are severable. I mean, that's important to realize. So that you can say, in the sequencing of this, you can say, well, you know, we're not prepared to go there yet. We're just going to do this for the employers. We're going to leave the individual market alone. Maybe we'll give it a 2-year commission to study it or something and see if we want to do that down the road. Okay? Or the subsidy scale. Again, these pieces are severable. You can do them in different sequences, depending on the state. Now, Massachusetts, they had a dysfunctional individual market, and this was a backdoor way of getting people out of that and into a better small group market, so they just did it right off the bat. But in this state or another state, you might want to do it differently. Those are your decisions.
The Massachusetts pool of individual policies was much smaller than what we have here.
Well, that's because they had a dysfunctional market, yeah.
One question that I have on the premium cost, it seems that if insurance companies are having to provide pre-existing condition and they're afraid of getting hit with a huge risk, that the price of the premiums will have to factor that in. If we have a guaranteed, you know, the OMIP model where the insurance companies share the cost for those that can't qualify for normal insurance, if we provided that for pre-existing conditions that are getting care and treatment for, say, 6 months prior to the time that the person comes on, that those, say, the substantial amount of those 85% of the cost of treatment for that pre-existing condition were out of the pooled coverage, and that way insurance companies knew that they didn't have to factor in to carry 100% of a quad or some serious problem that they didn't know about. Would that result in lower premiums? And because of the underwriting, they wouldn't have to always put in a provision.
It could. I there's a set of issues relating to selection in insurance and what you often term adverse selection. And there are really two basic concepts or two basic types of selection issues in health insurance. What I call the first order are the in-or-out questions. Am I in the market or am I out? Do I stay out until I'm sick and then want to buy insurance, for example? Do I say I'm young and healthy, I don't need it. If something happens to me, they're going to have to treat me at the hospital anyway and it'll get paid for, so why have health insurance? That's a serious adverse selection issue. That's a big problem. That is something you really have to work on and deal with. So, for example, if you do fold your individual market in, you can't have a parallel market. Okay, because that's the other first order selection. Well, do I go here to this option or do I go to this market? We saw this in states where a group of one could either be in the small group market or the individual market, and they had real problems in those states. The self-employed. Okay, so you really have to deal with those issues of in or out or between markets. Those are the really important ones. Now, what you're getting at is the second order selection, which is if you're in a market and people have choice, Some people will choose plan A, some will choose plan B, C, D, etc. Well, each of those plans is going to start from the position of saying, I'm afraid I'm going to get all the sick people. Because they have an overly inflated view of how good they are. They think they're better than all their competitors, so I'm obviously going to get all the sick people. And the way you deal with that is you either let them exclude sick people, which is what you do, and then say, well, no, those sick people go over here in a corner called the high-risk pool. Or you say, no, you've got to take those sick people, but on the back end, we're going to have a risk transfer reinsurance mechanism where you don't put the people in a corner, you put the claims in. So essentially, you come, each of you, 5-10 insurers, come to me with all your diabetics claims, and we'll put them all in a pot and redivide it and see if that makes a difference. Okay? Now, that's the kind of mechanism that you can apply to this kind of a model. And there are a lot of technical issues, and you could frankly do it. There's no right way. You can do it 7 different ways from Sunday on how to do it, because they're different types of claims. For example, all the diabetics. These are not necessarily going to be a spike in claims. They're going to be people who are consistently more expensive than people who aren't diabetic, right? Whereas somebody, you know, all the brain cancer cases, well, that's going to be a spike. You know, they're either going to go into remission or they're going to die, right? There's going to be a downside to that spike, okay? And then at that point on, it's going to level off. So there are different kinds of claims, and you can set up these pools in different ways to depending on which type you're trying to adjust for. But that would be the preferred way to deal with those. Now, transitioning from what you have today to there, there's some issues in how you get there. You have to think about what the new design is going to look like and when you want to transition.
Thank you, Rosie Maurer.
But shifting just a little bit, you mentioned delivery reform, and you said, oh, you had a list of things. Can you point me in a direction so that we don't spend a whole lot of time on that today? Because, in fact, that is a big issue here, and we are doing some things. I hope we're doing something. And a lot of it has to do, we talk about the medical home model, and we want to increase primary care. But a lot of this is about, delivery is set up based on how you pay for it. You know, as a clinic owner, we don't do things that we don't get reimbursed for. And so, you know, it's those, you know, incent me to do the right things. Mm-hmm. And whether it's increasing medical school, you mentioned medical school.
Essentially, the delivery issues at the state level are the one place where a sort of government rational planning sometimes makes a bit of sense in some states. It very much depends on the state you're in. So, for example, there's some states where they have a large presence of the Indian Health Service, and I'm thinking like South Dakota, Montana, Alaska, and so the conversation about how do we integrate that stream of federal money and that program which is run by the tribes and which only tribal members are eligible for with a state Medicaid program and with private insurance and do it both in terms of the financing and the delivery. I mean, if you're in a remote part of Alaska, you don't want two clinics, one for the natives and one
Oregon doesn't have.
Exactly. So then you move on to some of the other things. The medical school issue is a situation that I encountered in Louisiana, and then when I did some research, I found a state that had done it. Basically, like so much else in healthcare, there is an add-on payment in Medicare, two of them actually, direct medical education and indirect medical education payments to teaching facilities based on the number of residencies and based on their Medicare bed census. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what does that do? Well, that freezes in place essentially the system the way it was when the deal was done, however many years ago. But today that may not suit what you want. So a state that said, look, we want to shift and have more residencies in primary care and less in surgical specialties, and we want to distribute them in rural areas and not just concentrated in center city, went to the federal government and got a Medicare waiver to combine Medicare graduate medical education money with Medicaid and some private money, and they create a state workforce plan based on the kind of specialties we need and where we need them, and then they fund that graduate medical education and those residencies. And just as we're talking about the dollars following the patient here, in that case, in medical education, the dollars follow the resident. So this is the way to say, well, we're going to have more primary care and we're going to do more residencies in rural hospitals or clinics, or we're geriatricians, and we're going to do this in gerontology in nursing homes, say. Okay? And a geographic distribution. Now, the interesting thing is the state was Utah, and they did it when a guy named Mike Leavitt was governor, and he happens to be Secretary of Health and Human Services right now. So if this was something that might be of interest to your state, you've got just under 350 days to go talk to him. So these are some models of some of the things that might make sense. Now, when I had that conversation with the head of the medical school in the University of Mississippi, and we're talking about the Delta, you know, he's very interested in that. Okay, that's a big issue in the Delta. There are things that can be done with the federally qualified clinics, going back and talking with them. There's another paper that we've done on rethinking emergency medicine, because from nothing else other than a political point of view, when your average constituent thinks about the hospital, what do they think about? They think about the ER. But the ER serves as not only a public safety good, like police or fire, but it's also, under EMTALA, the de facto safety net. And prior to EMTALA, still, it's the second biggest source of revenue or revenue stream for the hospital. In other words, hospitals get revenue from either 60% of it is a national average, and it obviously varies from place to place, doctors referring in, and the other 40% is people coming in via the ER. Okay, they had something, heart attack, you know, been stabilized, now they have to have further treatment, etc. It's an insured patient. Okay, that's your revenue stream. Now, what happens is that we have conformed our emergency medical systems around where people happen to build ERs for their own reasons. Well, it happens in Washington, D.C., where I live. We've got, you know, George Washington University Hospital, excellent teaching hospital, and practically next door is Georgetown University Hospital, also an excellent teaching hospital. Why should the D.C. EMS service be conformed around that, as opposed to saying, look, we're going to pick an ER on the west side of town, I don't care which it is, and this one we will commit to keep open, and the other one, hey, you want to keep it open, fine, but it's your nickel, don't expect us to prop your hospital open. Okay? Now, when you rationalize that, as Maryland did, you can say, well, this is the facility for the level, for the trauma care, et cetera, and you can start to deal with some of those issues. Some of the boarding and diversion issues, are those big issues in this state? Because I know places where they are. Are hospital emergency room diversions a big issue here?
In Southern Oregon, we have a diversion program, but all the hospitals are on board because they basically one system.
Yeah. So. See, in some places it is. Because what's happened is, in some areas, if you're running the hospital and you've got an ER that's full of patients, okay, and some of those are patients who've been stabilized and who need further treatment and are paying, they can go upstairs, right? But here's the problem. Upstairs is full, or the beds are being held for Dr. So-and-so, who's bringing somebody in tomorrow for an operation. So what do you do? Well, here are your options. You can tell Dr. So-and-so, hey, cancel that surgery for that paying patient. I need the bed for this other paying patient. That's option one. Option two is to call the other hospital and say, hey, I've got a paying patient here, but I just don't have room for it. Why don't you take it? Option three is to tell that ambulance out there that has somebody that you don't know whether they're going to pay or not to go to the other hospital. And that's what you do. And that's not necessarily the best thing for patient care. If you redo the emergency room to say, well, no, it's independent from the needs of the hospital, and we just bring people in, we treat them, and then refer to them what's the most appropriate, you could do that. Now, that would be a major rethinking of emergency medicine. In some places, though, that might be justified.
I have a question. In Southern Oregon, some hospitals are working with the safety net clinics to provide dental care and other things to help take the pressure off the ERs. And in our state, there's seems to be two discussions. One is insurance, you know, healthy kids. We need to assure that all the children have insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there doesn't seem to be much discussion or enough discussion as to the focus shouldn't be just on insurance but on access to care. And so we have the whole safety net clinic and federally qualified health clinics and all of those things over here, and then you discuss about how many kids are uninsured, and is there a place or a way that there is a good coordination between insurance
and... Yeah, you have to start integrating this, too.
The
absolutely.
Integration. Where is that happening?
Absolutely. In some places, it happens better than others. In D.C., when we were looking at doing this, we had a system where they had closed the public hospital, and they were taking the money, much like Massachusetts did, and they were reprogramming it to the clinics. And we said, well, you know, if you just bought these people in, this is what eventually they did in Massachusetts, into this system, then they would just show up in your clinic, and they have an insurance card to pay for it. You could go about being their medical home and all the rest. And we discovered, well, they weren't set up to take insurance. It was something as simple as they didn't have the system to take insurance. If you came in with an insurance card, it's like the restaurant that says we don't take Visa or Amex, okay, you have to pay cash. Well, in this case, we can give it to you free, but if you happen to have coverage under insurance company, we can't charge them. Right? Well, gee, getting that fixed would be step one. Now, other states, they said, oh, no, we've got that all squared away in Texas. I mean, we've got that all covered. They can all accept the insurance cards. Okay, that's one way. Another thing is some of these clinics are associated with organizations that do other things for the target population and thus become a source for enrolling those populations in the insurance as well as delivering. So, again, the District of Columbia, when we set out to do this, the city's about 50% African American, about 35% Caucasian, and is about 8% Hispanic, and then there's some Asian, etc. The Hispanic population was the one that was disproportionately uninsured. Well, guess what? We've got a couple of clinics in those neighborhoods that serve those people. Well, why not pay, if you're going to pay an insurance agent a commission into this exchange, which I suggest you should do for bringing the business into the exchange and helping people pick a plan, why not pay that clinic or that agency that's providing social services to that target population the same amount? Give them the forms, pay them. Look, better than inventing a bureaucracy, they know who these people are. Those people trust them. If it's an immigrant population, you know, the language question, let them do the outreach. And what we discovered, actually, when we talked to them, it was very interesting. When we talked to them, we found that the pattern was that even as those people moved up the economic ladder and started having families and better-paying jobs and moved out of the city to the suburbs, and even after they got insured with an employer group coverage, they kept coming back to that clinic for their care. Well, why not? Of course. I mean, aside from the cultural issues, the fact of the matter is, I don't care who you are, the providers will say, you know, continuity of care is important. Having the same providers see you, or if you know these people, you trust them, you're comfortable, of course you should come back. Okay? So you want a system that does things like integrate into the reality of where people are as opposed to trying to move those people around. So yes, work with those clinics on a solution that's both the insurance and providing
taking it to the next level. Then if we have EMTALA, which basically says that there is access to care for everyone, and that is go to the emergency room, and we have safety net clinics that the federal government is promoting, and they're popping up all over the place, why is there not, or how would we go about integrating those two so that you have safety net clinics close to the hospital, and when someone comes in, instead of tying up an ER, if they're not an emergent situation, that they are referred over to the safety net clinic?
And that's exactly what I was suggesting. If you were to do an audit, if you will, start with an audit of urgent and emergency medical facilities in this state, and just divide it and say, start with, you know, the level one sort of 24/7 urgent care center. The next level is your general hospital ER, and then your specialized, you know, units, trauma, burn, etc. Okay? In any state that you did that audit, you would probably, and then come up with some metrics of what distribution do you think you ought to have in terms of population density relative. And there are people in the emergency medical field, you know, the associations and whatnot that can help with this. Okay? I would wager that in most states you would probably find that you had probably too many of the general level 2 hospital ERs and nowhere near enough of the 24/7 urgent care clinics. I mean, there's a certain amount of this is that you go to the ER because that's the only thing open at 3 in the morning when the baby's sick. Or it's 8 o'clock at night and I sliced my finger open making dinner. And this won't last. I mean, I did this myself years ago. You can't wait till tomorrow morning. Okay, where do I go? And just the question of what facilities are available is the first place to start with. Okay? And then you may or may not find, in terms of the trauma and the burn, that you have. As I said, Maryland did the first two pieces. They did the ERs and the trauma centers. What they didn't do yet is the 24/7 clinics. So a certain amount of it is resource planning. And I think that's an area where it's legitimate to do resource planning because it's like police and fire.
What's the matter?
I'm sorry. I mean, this is my bread and butter, so it's...
Well, we learn from it. Go ahead.
You know, it seems to me it's not the people that use the ER and are legitimately sick. I mean, who need an ER. You know, whether they have insurance or not, it is just the overwhelming number of people that use the ER because they know they don't have to pay. It's not because they...
They're using ER for primary care.
They're using ER for primary care, and we talked about an intolerable waiver, which doesn't exist. You can't do it. But is how do you get that urgent care or that primary care clinic, it's not even primary care, let's say urgent care clinic, co-located with that ER to relieve the pressure, because even that urgent care clinic becomes pretty expensive to operate. There's some logistics about how that operates. And so it's more expensive than primary care, but it's certainly a lot less expensive than ER care.
Well, that's what I do. Is you start with this planning question of do we have the right mix of and distribution of what we need? Then you move to the next question of if we answer this, just like what they did in Massachusetts, they said, "Well, I'm going to make it more affordable, more accessible, and subsidized." Now you're out of excuses for not having health insurance. Well, with this, we're going to rationalize the system. Now, you know, if you don't use the system properly, maybe we'll start charging you retrospectively if it turns out you've gone to the ER. Unnecessarily, you know, and that might be a policy. That would only be for people who aren't insured, because you know what? If they're insured, that's what their insurance company is going to do to them. So now you've got a system that when they show up uninsured, whether it's a clinic or a physician's office or the ER, the first thing you do is you put them into the system, and they start getting bombarded with, you know, here's the program, sign up, et cetera, and maybe even get billed. I mean, maybe, you know, this is part of the personal responsibility question. Do you start billing people for this stuff? But the premise is that you have to make the system fair and accessible for people first, before you can then put the responsibility on them. Because a system that says we don't care, yeah, sure, it encourages people to go and get free care. Of course they're going to do that. And there are people who turn down employer coverage because, well, if I took that, I'd have to pay something, and if I'm uninsured, I can get it free.
Any other questions? Ribsy Cannon.
Thank you. You know, we had a presentation, it was over a year ago, well, no, it was perhaps a year ago, I recall it from the beginning of our last session, where I think we heard that the major cost driver, the most significant cost driver in healthcare was technology. and it was the new equipment that's constantly coming on the market, and the provider wants and then passes on the cost to the insurer. How are incentives restructured under this system to maybe minimize that or reduce the sort of pace of technological change, if in fact that's a goal?
You don't want to reduce the pace of technological change. You want to optimize the use of it. And in fact, we do see some examples of that, you know, the most obvious and recent one being LASIK surgery, where you introduced a new technology and a new procedure, and the price keeps dropping and the quality keeps going up, and they're advertising on the extent to which they have expertise in doing that business. When you look at this from, as the folks at Harvard Business School do, from a macroeconomic model, you say we should see the same things happening with MRIs that we see happening with computers. I mean, look, you're talking about a large fixed investment that you're going to amortize. Well, obviously, the more you use the MRI, the lower the unit cost ought to go, if you had a real market. What you don't have is a real market that rewards that behavior of efficiently utilizing the machines. So the answer is not, in my view, more or less technology. The answer is the system into which it is introduced. When Apple produces the iPhone, it's introduced into a market dynamic that expects and rewards more for less. Okay? And so the features increase while the price declines. When somebody introduces a new pacemaker design or a new imaging technology, it's introduced in the healthcare system into a system in which it becomes an excuse for charging more and doing more. So it's the basic structure of the incentives.
Representative Kotek.
Chair, so why is that? And I think what I've been struggling with through your conversation is it works okay when we're talking about things that aren't as personal and life necessary as medical care. So we're talking about the MRI. Well, I can make a lot of money by charging a lot to do MRIs, but people are going to still need their MRIs. So I don't know how we get to the more for less, the value.
If somebody else offers more for less, they'll go elsewhere.
Is it offering a better imaging, or is it like saying I'm
cheaper.
Better reading it?
Well, there's two different things. One is, just at a very basic level, are you running that thing on a schedule where you're using it, where you're maximizing it? I mean, you know, come in for your MRI at 8 o'clock in the evening, it's half price. Okay?
Patient isn't incentivized to do that. They have no.
Nobody's in.
Well, but if it's someone who literally can't do that.
Let's look at it at the provider side. Let's look at it at the provider side. On the provider side, you have an investment. Okay? It's a large fixed cost. Okay? Now, the more you do with that investment, the quicker you amortize the upfront cost of buying it, and the sooner you turn a profit off of it. So one would imagine that you would run that 24/7 until you got to that point. That's in a market where you have to attract customers by offering access to that investment cheaper than the next guy. But in a market where you don't have to attract customers that way, you run it 9 to 5 and you charge whatever the insurance company will pay. And that's what we have going on in the system. So the kinds of things that you would expect to see don't happen because of the artificial nature of the system. What's funny about healthcare is it happens, but it happens in those weird margins where the system doesn't apply. So LASIK surgery is an example. It happens there where you've got a big investment in the equipment. You're driven to both amortize that cost and to demonstrate proficiency and results. So what happens is you get some providers who do a lot, and guess what? It gets cheaper and better at the same time. I have an example. In the British National Health Service, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is another one. I always love this one. The British National Health Service. The great thing about the NHS is because it's like the VA, everybody works for the government. They don't care what the doc does on the weekends or after hours. Okay? So if you can't get it on the NHS, because, of course, they're waiting lists, how about going private? Well, so doctors started treating people privately. Then they created private hospitals. They're now to the point, even years ago, where they built the private hospital on as a wing to the public hospital. A while back, and I don't know if they've done this recently, but I have the news stories from years ago when they did this, they ran sales over Christmas on orthopedic surgery. 20% off if you came in between Christmas Eve and, you know, a couple days after New Year's. 20% off the hip or knee replacements. These are common things. These are things it's hard to get on the National Health Service. Now, that sort of behavior you almost never see in healthcare. But why did you see it there? Well, because you got a hospital, it's got fixed costs, they're in there day in, day out. People don't want to be in over Christmas. It's better to have some revenue than no revenue to offset those fixed costs, because you're still going to be, you know, paying for the building and the equipment and et cetera over those days, even if you close up. So let's have a sale. And so we had sales on operations. I mean, the stuff can be done is the point. It's just that in the current system, there isn't the incentives to do it.
Well, and I have to mull this over, but LASIK's a tough example for me because that's an optional procedure for most people, you know.
Yeah, that's
a pair of glasses is a lot cheaper than LASIK.
I just have contacts,
you know,
yeah.
Right, so, you know, so I think you have a different flexibility there. It's not...
Well, this is where what I would suggest you do then is, and this is where somebody like Professor Regina Herzlinger's book, Who Killed Healthcare, or Michael Porter at, you know, Harvard Business School. I mean, they go through all these case studies, and it's not just LASIK. It's Duke University and doing, I was talking about this earlier today, and doing treating congestive heart failure. It's cancer treatments, etc. Where what they're showing is time. There's two sets of academic research. One is mainly John Wenberg at Dartmouth is the foremost, which shows that there are all sorts of disparities in the cost and outcomes of care, and they have no relationship to each other. That some places in this country are very high cost and very low quality. Okay. Louisiana, for example. And he does it down to the urban area. And he will take demographically identical urban areas and show wide variation in the procedures per, you know, like hysterectomies per 1,000 women of a certain age. Or, you know, coronary artery bypass per 1,000 men of a certain age. Okay? And he will show huge variations in both the frequency, in the cost, in the outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's no rhyme or reason here. Okay, so we know on the one hand, from Wenberg and those associated studies, the diagnosis of the problem. What Herzlinger and Porter provide us on the other end is the examples of what they call focus factories. That's one of their insights out of that, is that what they find repeatedly in heart care, cardiac care, cancer, diabetes management, whatever, is those that do a lot of it get good at it and they get cheaper while they get better. And that you get the same phenomenon in the, you know, in the Duke and the Dana-Farber Cancer Center and the Cleveland Clinics. You get the same phenomenon in these centers of excellence or focus factories in healthcare that you get in, say, IT, where next year's laptop has, you know, twice the speed and three times the memory at 30% less of a price. I mean, you get that same phenomenon. So there, so Wenberg and that work points out where the problem is and how widespread it is. And Herzlinger and Porter and some of these others point out how there are examples of where we could go. And so what happens if everybody was incentivized to go in that direction? Well, then those good providers would be overwhelmed. So one of two things would happen. They would either expand and grow and bring more people in and train them in their methods, or other people who were the next tier down were their competitors would say, you know, to catch up to them, to get that demand, we have to bring our standards up to theirs and our prices down to theirs to match. I mean, that's Apple Computer and Dell and that sort of. I mean, Apple takes the we can charge more because we put more features in it. Okay. You know, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Dell comes in and says, we can do the same thing, but we can do it a lot cheaper because we've come up with a more efficient way of doing it. So the evidence is out there. There are books, there are whole books on it, and I would just encourage you to read them. Because they do, the great thing about Harvard Business School people is they do case studies. So, you know, they'll give you the case study.
We have one more question.
You know, LASIK is not, quote, medically necessary, because there are alternatives to kind of getting to the same point. But the point is that it is still a health care, that's a procedure that's being delivered in a free market. Insurance doesn't cover LASIK. That's why that market is driven.
Well, I would agree with you except for one thing, and the issue is not whether the insurance covers it or not. The issue for me is who buys the insurance, okay? For example, the British private medical system works very much the same way, but it has insurance, but individuals purchase the insurance. So in other words, the insurer becomes an intermediary working for the patient to find them best and cheapest.
Okay.
That's an important distinction, because there are some people who advocate, well, let's just get rid of the insurance and have people pay more directly. If you want to do that, that's fine. But I'm saying this works as well when the insurance company works for you as your expert agent. Say, you know, my gosh, I've been diagnosed with breast cancer. Where do I go?
The insurance companies, the MRI as an example, is there's no competition on price. Medicare,
right.
The private insurance, they reimburse for every procedure exactly the same,
right,
whether it's necessary or not.
Right.
And so the more necessary they can find, they're going to do more of it.
And so since there's no
incentive,
since there's no very, since they will pay, yes, they treat all MRIs the same. That's right. And we pay the same. That's right. Okay. That's absolutely right. So, of course, there's no shopping either by you as a consumer or by your surrogate, because your surrogate isn't working for you. They're just administering the pricing system. In other words, your insurer as a surrogate isn't saying, hey, if you get your MRI over here, it's half the cost.
Yeah.
And we pass the savings on to you. In other words, for example, I've been starting to think about this. How would insurers and providers deal with each other in this kind of a reform system? And I think we mentioned in one of the earlier meetings, I would envision a world in which the insurers would start to move to tiered copays based on price and quality, just like the PBMs did with drugs.
Yep.
So the higher the quality and the lower the price, the lower your copay, to steer people in that direction. Say, well, you can get your MRI anywhere you want, but these are the ones who, you know, or you can get your foot surgery anywhere you want, but these are the ones who will do the best results at the best price, so the copay is going to be much lower here. Now, on this other end of the spectrum, you can go to them, but we're just going to expect you to pay a lot more for it. See, right now, we pay every doctor the same as if they're all equally good. We pay for every MRI as though it's the same. Whether they bought the machine yesterday or bought it, you know, 5 years ago and have basically more than made back what they spent on it. Well, they should be cutting their prices, right? But we're not set up to recognize that. We just say, MRI, this is what we pay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. What that does point out to us is that the movement that our state is making toward greater transparency as far as what hospitals are charging, what costs are for various procedures, if that continues to expand and there is a greater responsibility on patients, they will have choices that they can make instead of just saying, I'm hurt, I'm going to the doc. You know, you had mentioned earlier that in two hospitals in Boston, one charges, was it $3,000 for a normal delivery, and one across town is $6,000.
Well, and they're both Harvard hospitals.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that was the fun part, because in Massachusetts, it's the best in the world. How do you know? Because it's Harvard. Well, wait a minute. why are they charging two different prices?
It'd be great to be able to have.
I think they're both Harvard. Even if they weren't both Harvard, it's the whole point is, yeah, it's like, you know, that huge difference.
And I think the other piece is that truly the insurance carriers are much more well equipped to identify those quality measures. The consumer isn't going to be able to parse out who's stent replacement has lower infection rates.
And you would go beyond that. I mean, I would envision multiple competing standards from, say, academic medical centers. So the insurance companies could latch onto them. You know, they could advertise, we apply the Mayo standards, or we apply the Hopkins standards. Yeah. Sorry.
Mr. Hazelmeyer, thank you so much for your input, your information. We would like to be on an email list to get...
Oh, absolutely, please. I have your cards. If I haven't, I will certainly add you to our list. And we continue to produce a number of technical papers on how to do it and be happy to, as I said, go around and help you as a sort of quasi-consultant on this.
On behalf of our committee, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and close this committee.
Great. Thank you, Dennis.